I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Michael Steinberger has strong opinions about wine. He calls Robert Parker's 100-point scale a farce. He calls Sauvignon Blanc a complete dud of a grape. He says wine lovers should head south of San Francisco to Santa Cruz instead of north to Napa and Sonoma to find good California wine. He questions traditional wine and food pairings, and he says that Burgundy is better than Bordeaux. Michael Steinberger is the wine writer for Men's Journal, author of a new book called The Wine Savant, A Guide to the New Wine Culture. His Vanity Fair article, A Vintage Crime About Wine Fraud, won the 2013 James Beard Foundation Journalism Award. It's been a couple of years, and Michael Steinberger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. And I should say to our listeners, he brought three bottles of wine and a bottle of champagne at 10 in the morning.
It is a pleasure to be back with you. Thanks for having me back, and glad I was able to come with some bottles today.
Indeed, we are as well. So what is this new wine culture? Where did it come from?
Well, the point behind the book, the impetus for writing it, is that we've become a nation of enophiles, I think. A very self-confident wine culture has taken root in the United States. 20, 25 years ago, ordering a glass of Chardonnay or Cabernet in certain parts of the country might have gotten you beaten up.
Because you were that kind of a drinker, right?
Well, exactly. We were a shot and beer country for a very long time and had an innate suspicion of wine, and that's changed. We've become a very self-confident nation of wine drinkers, very open-minded, ecumenical in our taste and choices. I would say we're the most open-minded and enthusiastic wine drinkers on the planet these days, and I thought the time had come to write a book that tailored to this new culture.
Would you say it's because there's more wine being made in this country, that there's a more globalized world that we live in, so it's possible to drink wines from all over the world easily?
We've got more choices than ever before on our shelves. It is a globalized wine market, and just have so many incredible choices from all over now, so much more to choose from. But we have just embraced wine with great, great enthusiasm. You know, I talk in the book about the film Sideways,
yes,
which was very deep in the weeds as wine goes. And I remember sitting in the theater cringing, thinking to myself, oh, my God, you know, I'm embarrassed for him, for us as wine drinkers, thinking this is going to set back wine culture forever. But it didn't have that effect. In fact, people just went crazy over that movie, and among its many byproducts, they completely turned on Merlot, and it touched off the Pinot Noir craze in this country. So, yeah, we're in a very different place as a wine-drinking country than we were 15, 20 years ago.
But what's interesting is there's so much great beer to drink now. So it's not as exactly, you know, either or. Hopefully it's both and.
Well, this beer thing is sort of ticking me off
because just as
wine is having its moment, along come the beer folks who've been dominant for so long with the craft beer movement. And it is an incredible thing. But, you know, let us have a moment in the sun, please.
So why do you love wine so much?
Well, I think it's great pleasure. A glass of wine, a bottle of wine is an incredible pleasure. It is, as I say in the book, it is the one alcoholic beverage that not just gives that kind of pleasure, but that really makes us think, if we choose to think about it. We don't have to. There's no obligation to think about what you're drinking, but if you do, it's both in terms of the complexity of the wine itself, but just things, you know, you look at the vintage, you think back, what was I doing in 2005 or 1995 or whenever that wine was bottled, and you think back to your life, and it brings back milestones and so forth. And that's one of the many things I love about wine.
You talk about what makes for a great wine. You say aromatic complexity, concentration, balance, crescendo, and length. All right, let's start with aromatic complexity.
Well, it's got to have the first thing you do when you take a sip of wine. Before you even take a sip of wine, you should swirl the glass a little bit. We've got a glass of champagne in front of us.
Here we go. Monday morning.
This is a non-vintage.
10:10 a.m.
Exactly. It's 5:10 someplace in the world, right? This is from Pierre Peters, a great grower, champagne producer, and we can talk a little bit about that later. But, you know, you swirl the glass a little bit, and you just put it to your nose, and you smell.
Right.
And there's complexity there. It's an inviting smell, and you know, you don't have to sit here. One of the things I talk about in the book, you don't have to pick out every aroma you think you detect. I mean, you know, you see these tasting notes, and they're listing all sorts of cherries, berries, caramel-coated autumn leaves. That was one of my favorite ones.
What does that mean?
It doesn't mean very much, you know. You don't have to do that whole thing, but there is complexity that you want to detect in glass. You want the wine to catch your attention. You want it to intrigue you with its aroma. And because when we're tasting wine, we're really mostly smelling, even when it's in the mouth. through what's called the retro, through the retronasal passage, because with the mouth we're only picking up five basic sensations, sweetness, saltiness, and so forth. But it's really with the smell where we're picking, where we're experiencing the wine.
Which is why the shape of the glass is so important, right?
The shape of the glass is important, you know. But I talk in the book about, you know, the whole glass thing, because that has become an industry unto itself, thanks chiefly to a very enterprising family of Austrian glassmakers named the Riedels. Who have come up with a glass for basically every grape. And not just grapes, but certain, you know, for instance, they came out with a glass for Oregon Pinot Noir. They've got a glass for Tempranillo. They've got a glass for everything. And God bless their enterprising hearts, but we don't need that many glasses. In fact, I just use one basic glass for everything, even for champagne. It's this the Bordeaux stem. I've got a Spieglau here, which is a very good brand that's owned by Riedel. These are really nice glasses, but cheap enough to break. That's important, too. Riedel are really expensive. That can ruin your night if you break a Riedel. These are cheap to break. So,
and tell us what we're drinking here. This is champagne.
This is champagne. This is Pierre Peters, non-vintage champagne. Pierre Peters is one of the producers at the vanguard of what's known as the grower champagne movement. When we think of champagne, we usually think of big houses like Veuve Clicquot and Tatanger, Roederer, and so forth. These houses, for the most part, own few, if any, vineyards of their own. They buy grapes from hundreds of grape growers throughout the Champagne region, and then they blend the grapes together to make their wines. And the emphasis with these houses tends to be on making wines that express the house style. Some of these grape growers, however, choose not to sell their grapes. They choose to make the wines themselves. A lot of them don't do a very good job, but some of them do an incredible job. And Pierre Peters is one of them. And what's interesting is they are changing our conception of champagne. You know, we have always tended to think of champagne as just this sort of frivolous thing, something that stands apart from other wines. And the grower movement, because they work on a much smaller scale, not just in terms of production, but because they're usually working in just a single village or even a single vineyard, and sometimes just with a single grape, they are getting us to think of champagne as a wine that expresses a sense of place. Their whole thing is not expressing a house style. It's expressing a sense of place through their wines. And so it's really changing the way we think about champagne. They make fantastic wines, and Pierre Peters, as I said, is one of the best.
Yeah, it has a nice crispy, kind of a crispy taste. That would be my first impression.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I should say our guest just spit his wine into a glass.
Yeah, spitting thing. I've been writing about wine for a long time, but the spitting thing is still a challenge for me. I mean, you know, and I'm
thank you for sharing that.
And, you know, it's I've been working on it for years, practicing in the shower, but it just, you know, I think I've got a really good palate, but the spitting thing is a challenge.
Let me quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to give out that phone number again. That's Michael Steinberger, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of a new book called The Wine Savant, A Guide to the New Wine Culture. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or stories or comments you might have, do give us a call. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaim. These other things that you look for: concentration, balance, crescendo length. Crescendo.
Just you want to build across the palate. And of course, these are very subjective judgments, but they're things that you can learn by tasting. I mean, the point I make is that, you know, how do you learn to be a good taster? You taste.
Right.
That's the thing. You can read about wine, and I encourage people to read wine about wine as much as they can, but you have to taste. Taste as many wines as you can, as often as you can. You don't have to go crazy with it. Do what you can. But, I mean, the more you taste, the more experience you're going to be, the more you're going to know what you like, and the more these things are going to stand out to you. You know, and you do have to sort of experience better wines to the extent that you can. You don't have to go crazy. I mean, not everyone has to buy a $300 bottle of wine, but the better the wines, the more you're going to understand these things. You're going to
layers of
complexity, and you know, you're going to that depth I talk about, that crescendo, that sense it's building to a grand finale across the palate, and then the finish. You want the wine to linger on the palate. You want the aftertaste to linger, and these are the components of really good wines.
You say an underrated feature of wine is what you call texture, and an overrated feature is fruitiness.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got, you know, grapes are fruit, right. So you know, fruit is important, but I think certainly with Parker, you mentioned Robert Parker before. He really does love exuberant fruitiness. And I think, I mean, I like fruitiness in a wine, but I like other things. I like savory care aspects too. So, you know, fruit is not the be-all and end-all, despite what Parker said, in my opinion anyway. and texture, how it feels in the mouth. These are things you can perceive. I mean, for instance, one of the reasons I like Burgundy is because it's got a silky quality in the mouth. I mean, it's just so supple. It just kind of glides across the palate. Other wines are much heavier, denser. I mean, take an Australian Shiraz. I mean, it leaves elephant prints on your tongue.
Is that texture?
That is texture. So, texture is something we haven't really been taught to think about as much. And, I think it's an important aspect of wine.
Well, speaking of Robert Parker, you call his 100-point scale, and I'm quoting here, a farce.
Well, I think
you talk about grade inflation.
Well, I think the idea that you can put a number, a specific number on a wine I understand it's shorthand. It's a way of expressing one's view of a wine, one's opinion of a wine. And the thing is, it's difficult to write about wine, difficult to convey through words, impressions of a wine. So, the scoring system has taken off for that very reason. Much easier to say, oh, that's 96 points than to have to wade through the gobbledygook of a standard tasting note. But, to put that level of specificity, 96, 97 points, which suggests a sort of scientific precision, is very misguided, I think. And the reality is, I give Parker a lot of credit. I don't think anyone has done more than Parker to get Americans excited about wine. But with this whole 100-point scale, I remember a couple of years ago I did an interview with David Shaw, a very fine writer for the LA Times, and Shaw wanted to put him to the test, test him over 2 or 3 days. Could you repeat, giving the same 6 wines, not identifying those wines, would you give the same score to each one? And he wouldn't do it because he said, I got everything to lose and nothing to gain. And so he was on it. Parker was honest about it. But that's the thing. If you can't reproduce these things, these results, over and over, I don't see why, 96, 97 points, that's a level of precision that I don't think you can achieve.
Because it seems to me that with wine and with a lot of things, it's context, it's who you're with, it's what you're eating, it's what's the view out the window. I mean, there are all these, the atmosphere around you.
Those are things. I mean, that's absolutely true. And that's the way most of us experience wine. I mean, as someone who writes about wine, I can say that context doesn't make that much of a difference to me. I prefer to drink a bottle of Romane Conti in the company of people that I love, but if I have to drink it in the bathroom at an airport, I can still judge the wine. that has not happened.
I was going to say, I'm trying to. You've already spat in front of me. I didn't know.
No, that has not happened. That has not happened, though I do know some collectors who once drank a bottle of very, very old Romane Conti in the bathroom of a hotel.
Really?
It was.
Were they hiding from people?
I think they were hiding. I think they just wanted to hoard it for themselves. But I think so. These things can be judged in and of themselves. You don't need context to determine whether a wine is good, really good, or just off the charts great. But context does matter for most of us. I mean, with food, with people we love, the company you keep, so forth.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And we're talking about wine with our guest, Michael Steinberger. And he is the wine writer for Men's Journal, author of a new book called The Wine Savant, A Guide to the New Wine Culture. And any questions or comments that you might have, or even stories that you might want to tell about wine, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Michael brought in 3 bottles of wine, a bottle of champagne. We're going to do some more talking and tasting after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Studio Incaminati School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City, Philadelphia supports WHYY. Classes are now forming for its 5-day January workshops and weekly continuing education classes. In small groups taught by award-winning professional artists, students develop their creativity while strengthening their skills. Fine art drawing and painting instruction for all levels features work on portrait, figure, and still life. Classes begin January 13th. For details, studioincaminati.org.
There are only 2 days left to get your year-end tax deduction. Don't let time run out. Support WHYY now to help us end the year on a high note. Whether you give a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, throughout all the unrest in the Muslim world, one Muslim country has been holding steady. But now even Turkey's government is in turmoil. Can the Prime Minister hold on? And what does it mean for the United States? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Turns out more Americans are drinking more wine, a trend that's been happening for the past 10 to 20 years. Our guest, Michael Steinberger, writes about all of this and also writes about why he loves wine and why we should all love wine in his new book called The Wine Savant. Again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Michael, you have, during the break, you poured a Chenin Blanc.
This is a South African Chenin Blanc from a terrific producer named Adi Badenhorst. It's called the Secateurs Chenin Blanc, one of several wines that Badenhorst produces in a region called Swartland, which is near Cape Town. What I love about this wine is not just that I love Chenin Blanc, not just that this is crisp and a really good wine, but this is one of the wines that has now got me excited about South Africa. Mm. South Africa has been much in the news recently. The wine industry has been enjoying a revival since apartheid ended, but you know, it's been more the idea of South African wines than the reality. There's been good wines produced, but not stuff that's gotten us really excited. But Badenhorst is part of a group of producers in this region. It's quite rugged region, about an hour and a half, 2 hours from Cape Town,
wow,
who are really making very, very exciting wines. One of the things they're doing, and there was a big concern 10 years ago that we were going to be, the wine world was going to be overrun by Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah. That's how you say it. All right.
And that was the big concern. And it turned out that has not been the case. And you know what you see all over the wine world is people deciding that their comparative advantage, if you will, is focusing on grapes that are native to the region or that have had a long history where they can do something really different and unusual. And Chenin Blanc has been grown in South Africa for a very long time. I mean, the grape reaches its apogee in the Loire Valley of France, where it goes under names like Vouvray and Savigny.
Oh, sure, sure.
But some of the smarter producers in South Africa have realized that, you know what, we do a better job. We can distinguish ourselves more on the international market with Chenin Blanc than we can with Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc. And Badenhorst is one of the people leading that charge, doing some really good red wines as well. And this is a $15 wine, and it punches well above its weight, I think, relative to the price. This is a wine I drink a lot of at home. It's just, it's really good.
Let me give it a little taste here.
Right. See what you think.
All right.
And, of course, you're under no obligation to agree with me. Even if I am your guest.
I'm fussy about my wines. That's not very light.
Isn't it?
Has a light taste, yes.
Isn't it? I mean, this is a grape that I'd love to see people embrace more. As I said, it reaches its pinnacle in the Loire Valley of France. Great Vouvrays. We talked about Sideways before. I mean, the great moment for all the wine geeks in the crowd was when Miles, the lead character in Sideways, talks about Huet. Huet is the iconic producer in the Loire Valley. So that just had us falling out of our seats with pleasure.
Think of Vouvrays having a kind of a sweetness to it.
Well, they can. I mean, Chenin Blanc is a very protean grape. It can... And Huet, just to name one house, they make four different ways. They make a dry Vouvray, they make off dry, they make sweet, and they also make sparkling. This is a good champagne substitute as well. So it's a very protean grape. You can do all sorts of stuff with it. And the South Africans are starting to make serious inroads with this grape. They've had a long history of it, and I think Badenhorst is doing really good stuff with it.
And this is a twist top wine, and I wonder. I mean, you write about fake the authentic corks, I guess, the synthetic corks, and then the corks, and then the screw tops.
Yeah, no, screw tops are catching on. I mean, it's a being embraced all over, particularly in the new world, old world.
Are we the new world?
We are. Okay. We are. But even more so than us. I mean, the Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans as well. And, it's I will admit that I'm a bit of a sentimentalist. I do like the sound of a cork, but I don't like the issue. The reason we want to get away from corks is because cork taint, TCA, if you ever smell a wine and you smell basically wet cardboard, and the wine doesn't seem to have the sort of fruitiness you'd expect, it's been affected by cork taint. And that's the problem. They think 5 to 10% of corks are affected by it. The problem has, there seems to be some improvement because there's been pressure now. Cork producers are under pressure to do a better job and to control for this problem more because you have these alternative closures now. Screw caps. I mean, I've got mixed feelings about them. I do. One of the things you don't get.
That's for the Boone's Farm days.
Yeah, exactly. It just takes a little romance out of it. I mean, I'm not that much of a romantic when it comes to wine, but I mean, it does take a little bit out of it. And you know, there is. I do sometimes find with wines that are under screw cap that there's a little bit of reduction. It's sort of that that skunky smell you find in beer sometimes because there's no oxygen coming through. But other people disagree about that. I may just be persnickety about this.
You said Sauvignon Blanc. Why don't you like Sauvignon Blanc?
It's a grape that just does not make me happy.
No.
And you know, I think some wine writers, I suppose, don't think you should say those sorts of things. Don't want to, we should just be cheerleaders for all grapes, all styles, and so forth. I don't subscribe to that idea. I realized
it's too generic-y tasting.
We talked about complexity before. Yeah. I just don't find even the better examples. I don't find the kind of complexity you find, say, in Riesling or Chardonnay or Chenin Blanc. It just doesn't have that complexity that holds my interest past more than a few sips. And I've taken ever since I wrote about my disdain for Sauvignon Blanc, I mean, people just never let me live that down, which is fine. I mean, yes. I was corresponding the other day with a wine writing friend in California. We talked about getting together in 2014, and he says, maybe over a glass of Sauvignon Blanc. And this is years later with a smiley face after that. It's My answer to everyone is, if you love Sauvignon Blanc, don't let me discourage you from drinking it, and just think of it this way. More for you.
Exactly. And that's Michael Steinberger. He's wine writer for Men's Journal, author of a new book called The Wine Savant, A Guide to the Wine Culture. And we are talking not just about the culture, but also about the many more choices that wine drinkers have, some of the interesting trends out there as well. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. You talk about if you're in San Francisco, you can go north, go to Napa, go to Sonoma. There's lots of wine up there. You suggest people go south to Santa Cruz.
Well, Santa Cruz Range is an area that I think that's the real sweet spot in California, and historically has produced some of California's greatest wines and continues to produce absolutely amazing wines. There's Ridge Vineyard, which is sort of the iconic producer of Cabernet Sauvignon in California and has been making just incredible wines, wines that can hold their own against the very best Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. Been doing this since the 1960s. There's a new producer in the Santa Cruz Range called Rhys, R-H-Y-S. Now, I'll disappoint everyone and tell you that these wines are so sought after now. There's a waiting list to get on the mailing list. But they make the best New World Pinot Noirs I've ever tasted, as well as incredible Chardonnays and Syrahs. It's an incredible area that has this remarcable history. And what stands out about it is the geological diversity. It's situated between the bay, the ocean, just all sorts of really really beneficial factors at play. And the success they have, not just with Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Syrah, and even Pinot Noir. I mean, it's very rare to have in a small area success with four grapes like that because they usually require very different circumstances. And it's the unfortunate thing with the Santa Cruz Range is the yields are very small. They can't produce a lot of wine. So it's never going to supplant Napa and Sonoma as sort of the standard bearers for California. But I think it is, as I said, the real sweet spot in California. It's just interesting, right above Silicon Valley on the San Francisco Peninsula. And that is a place that produces magical wines.
Does that mean that what's coming out of Napa and Sonoma is more sort of factory
making? No, there's some really good stuff coming out of there, and Sonoma is particularly exciting. I mean, one of the things you're seeing in California, and we can talk a little bit more about that. I've got an example of this with a Chardonnay we can taste. But you see now sort of the most interesting work is being done not with Cabernet Sauvignon, which has always been Napa's calling card, but with Chardonnay, Syrah, and Pinot Noir. And those are really grapes that are done mostly in Sonoma. Hmm. And in fact, some of the most interesting ones are coming from the far Sonoma coast, I mean, 2 miles in from the Pacific. I mean, very, very rugged country out there. And some really impressive wines are being made. So I don't mean to suggest that Sonoma and Napa don't make good wines, but the Santa Cruz Range, which doesn't get a lot of attention, as I said, always been a really magical spot for wine in California.
And you think that fog that rolls in, I mean,
it's
all those
sorts of factors.
It's
an incredible thing. I mean, it sits on some tectonic plates, and has created just incredible geological diversity. I mean, just the rocks, I mean, all sorts of stuff in there that just have lend themselves to incredible wines.
So why is Burgundy better than Bordeaux? Chapter heading.
Ties in with the Pinot Noir craze. I have always preferred Burgundy, the wines. There's a sensual pleasure with the wines. I quote someone, and I have to be very careful because this is family radio. I quote someone in the book, so I'm going to put this more gingerly than I do in the book. This person said, the difference between Bordeaux and Burgundy, Bordeaux makes you urinate. Burgundy makes you fornicate. Can I say that?
You can.
All right. You put it rather more crudely and colorfully, but there is a sensual pleasure with Burgundy that just can't be beat. It's an expensive pleasure. Burgundies are expensive. They don't produce a lot of wine in Burgundy, and it can be hit or miss. Pinot Noir is a very ornery grape.
Difficult to grow.
And, I mean, you know, the wines, you know, they close up after bottling. You know, you have to catch them on the right day. So, you know, it's very hit or miss. It's gotten a lot better. Burgundy, one of the reasons people are so excited about Burgundy these days is because the quality has become so much more consistent. Improvements in winemaking, the weather has gotten more consistent. It really hasn't been, I think the last really, really bad vintage, you could say, is probably 1994. Uh-huh. So, I mean, every year now produces wines that are worth drinking. Some years are better than others, of course, but it's been really in a golden age of Burgundy winemaking now.
You even say that the climate change has, at least I guess in some parts of the world, maybe been good for winemaking?
Short to medium term, it's been pretty good. I mean, you're getting a level of consistency. I mean, for instance, in places like Burgundy and the Loire Valley, if you got two really good vintages in a decade, this is 30 or 40 years ago, that was a pretty good decade. Now, if you have one or two bad ones, that's not so great. I mean, no. It's really changed
because
quite dramatically.
It literally is warmer?
It's warmer, more consistent.
More temperate.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, long term, it's a big concern because, these grapes sit on it's a very fine balance. I mean, with a place like Burgundy, it's quite northern region of France. And, you know, it's like as far north almost as you could possibly hope to grow these grapes. And, there's this fine balance you have between acidity and ripeness. They get just ripe enough, but they retain the acidity. And if those things get if the climate changes, those things get knocked out of balance, you lose those things that make these wines magical.
Let me get, looks like Ross from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Ross, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Hi.
I'm great, thanks. Question for you based on exactly what you're saying is, what's your opinion on sort of this homogenization of the blended wines where they are making the blend different from year to year to be the consistent taste from year to year rather than the influences of nature and the earth? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Ross.
Well, I assume you're talking about champagne maybe. Yeah, with champagne, I mean, listen, the big houses, which, you know, as I said, put an emphasis on, they want their wines to foremost show the house style. They make great wines. I mean, some of them make better wines than others, but, you know, Roederer is a terrific house. I mean, Tatanger makes really fantastic wines. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that, and blending is part of the art of champagne making, and it is an art. I mean, there's really something quite incredible about the process. But we've got this new side of champagne represented by the growers who are saying it's not about, you know, house style, but, you know, the Champagne region is this very vast area. There are differences from one vineyard to the next, from one village to the next, that are worth exploring in the wines, and that the wines shouldn't, you know, the point of these wines shouldn't be to show our style, quote unquote, but to explore these differences from one terroir to the next.
You say something interesting about pairing food and wine. Basically, champagne goes with with everything.
Champagne is incredibly versatile. It's just, you know, it's It works with everything, I think. I drink it all the time with whatever. It goes with sushi. It goes with all sorts of things. One of the things I talk about in the book is, we've got this trend now of tasting menus, lots of small dishes.
Yes,
you go to restaurants and they're serving you 10, 12, 15 small plates. And that can be a challenge with wine pairing because one bottle of white or red, it doesn't go with everything. A glass with each of those courses, 10 or 15 glasses over the course of an evening could be a lot. Champagne is one way to bridge the gap with all these. It works really well. It's just a very versatile. It's got the acidity, which cleanses, refreshes the palate. John Maynard Keynes, the late great economist, said his one regret in life was that he didn't drink enough champagne. I am not going to let that be my epitaph.
Let me see what Rodney from Germantown has to say. Hi, Rodney. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yes. Fascinating discussion. I just wanted to make a few comments. One, you're talking about the Burgundy wines, and I just wanted to point out the excellence in the coming of age of the great Pinot Noirs of Oregon, especially the Willamette Valley, which have really given a run for their money to the Burgundies. And I think, actually, there's even more variety, even though it's a small area in Oregon where they grow it relatively, I think there's actually more of a spread of characteristics that you'll get there than in the Burgundy regions in France. And
that's interesting.
Just one other point, as far as smaller regions people don't hear about, a couple of years ago I was in Southern California in the Temecula Valley, which produces some really nice wines at very reasonable prices and is a kind of a mini Napa, which is a beautiful place to visit.
That sounds great, Rodney. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Michael.
No, Oregon is... there's some terrific wines being produced in Oregon, and it's indicative of the promise of Oregon that you've got some leading names from Burgundy buying vineyards there, making wines there. Domaine Turin has been making wines, and it's one of the great houses in Burgundy. They've been in Oregon for a very long time. Others have followed. Dominique Lafon, a great, great winemaker in Burgundy, has been involved in Oregon. So they see the promise, and there's some terrific wines. And, one of the interesting things is, we live in this sort of globalized world, and I talk in the book about the Judgment of Paris in 1976, when a couple of upstart American wines won a blind tasting in Paris, a tasting that involved some French wine eminences.
Mon Dieu, right?
It was scandalous. Yes. It was scandalous. I mean, it was, Aubert de Villene, the head of Domaine de la Romanée Conti, Burgundy's most acclaimed site, was one of the tasters, and he said he was persona non grata when he returned to Burgundy. But he did say that it was the best kick in the rear, shall I say, that the French could have received, because it showed that there was competition from other places, that French wines would not in the future be able to sell themselves simply by virtue of being French wines. And the smart producers started traveling all over. And you see this now because there's this dissemination of ideas and these people, the French travel to Oregon, they travel to California, they send their sons and daughters to work there. The Californians and Oregonians send their sons and daughters to apprentice in Burgundy and elsewhere in France. And just, this remarkable cross-pollination. And I think it's pretty producing great wines everywhere.
And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. And again, our guest is Michael Steinberger. He's the wine writer for Men's Journal, author of The Wine Savant, A Guide to the Wine Culture. We're going to take another short break, talk some more. We've got a couple of more bottles here as well. And I do want to talk to him about an article that he wrote for Vanity Fair earlier this year, won the 2013 James Beard Foundation Journalism Award about a wine fraud, if I can say. Give us a call, 1-888-479-7794-99. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra presents Cirque de la Symphonie. Aerial acrobats literally drop into the Kimmel Center, each gravity-defying feat choreographed to music. Acrobats, contortionists, dancers, jugglers, all this and more, performing to music above and around the orchestra. Cirque de la Symphonie. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. This Friday and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the Philadelphia Orchestra presents Cirque de la Symphonie.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue Listener's Choice Week with musician, arranger, and band leader Vince Giordano. He and his band, the Nighthawks, performed the music for the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Also, the golden age of industrial musicals. we talk with the author of a book about lavish Broadway-style musicals written for corporate sales conventions. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We've all seen the bumper sticker, "The more you give, the more you receive." I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll discuss the science and the meaning behind these sentiments. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. According to a recent Gallup poll came out earlier in the summer, wine has actually caught up with beer as the alcohol of choice for Americans who drink. That represents a pretty dramatic increase in wine drinking over the last two decades. And we're talking about what explains this trend and also talking about what to look for in a good bottle of wine. Michael Steinberger is our guest, again taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet me at Marty Moss Coane. During the break, Michael, you poured another bottle. This is from
This is from Santa Barbara County. This is from a new producer called Sandhi, S-A-N-D-H-I. It's a label that's been brought out by a top sommelier from San Francisco named Raj Parr, working with a very accomplished winemaker named Sashi Moorman. Uh-huh. And this is one of the wines that's at the vanguard of a really fascinating thing in California. California has become a very exciting wine region now. There's a pendulum shift we're seeing away from sort of these big, broad-shouldered wines, the kind of wines, I mean, I know we're picking on Parker a little bit today, but away from what he called hedonistic fruit bombs.
the high-end whiskey.
Well, high alcohol, just very thick wines, thick, you could stand a spoon in them sometimes. There's been a shift away from that, mostly with Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and with Syrah as well. The idea that less is more, lower alcohol, less oak, wines with more subtlety and nuance, wines that are modeled, in the case of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, after Burgundy. They're not trying to mimic Burgundy. Right. I mean, it's California, not Burgundy, but very much modeled after that. So, for instance, this is 13% alcohol, which is quite modest as far as California Chardonnay goes. And they've been only doing this a couple of years, and the results have been hugely impressive, particularly with Chardonnay, I think. I mean, this is a very different, you think of California Chardonnay, it's been for years the punchline to a joke. You think buttery, round, treacly. I know.
Horrible.
not my favorite either. And, this is one of the wines that is making people excited again about California Chardonnay. These guys are, they're finding sites that produce riper grapes but with lower sugar levels, so therefore less alcohol in the end result, and wines with just minerality, great complexity, and lots of acidity. Pleasure to drink. It's a new face of California.
Let me try it.
See what you think.
That's a Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Mm. Very nice. Nice, it doesn't really...
No, it's not. It's just, it's crisp, it's clean, it's got complexity. That's a California Chardonnay you could drink over the course of an evening. Those butterball Chardonnays are not. Those are cocktail wines.
You also write in your book about the importance of understanding the importers, and I'm probably going to show my ignorance here, but just that it's a look for the importer, and that will tell you a lot about a bottle of wine.
Well, with domestic wines, that's not an issue because they're labeled Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, right, and so forth, so that's easy. But, people are often confused by foreign wines. They walk into the French section and they see, for instance, Mâcon Village, and they don't realize that Mâcon Village is a Chardonnay, but it doesn't say Chardonnay on the grape, and this is because the idea behind... sort of the philosophical underpinning of French viticulture is the idea that place matters more than grape, and so that's why you won't see, except in the case of Alsace, where they do put the grape name on the label, you won't see the grape name on the label of a bottle of Burgundy or a bottle of Syrah from the Northern Rhone. It'll say Cornas instead. One way of sort of navigating the foreign section of a wine shop is to flip the bottle around, see who brought it in. And this is something I discovered very, very early in my wine drinking days, that one of the reasons we drink so well in this country now is because we've had a group of incredible importers, very passionate people who've spent their lives traveling the back roads of France, Italy, Spain, finding these incredible unknown producers and bringing their wines here. Mm-hmm. and they have just blessed us with the most incredible selection of wines. For instance, I've got this next bottle we'll taste. This is a Kermit Lynch import. You flip the bottle around, you see Kermit Lynch with, you know, he's got the Thomas Jefferson quote, "A good wine is a necessity of life for me." You see that label anywhere, you're pretty much guaranteed a good bottle of wine.
Is it important to find a wine store or liquor store that where people know your tastes and are on the lookout for a good bottle for you? Now, we're in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
And you live in Delaware, so it's a different culture.
Pennsylvania is a tricky place. my short answer to people in Pennsylvania is go across the state line. You'll do better.
You know that's against the law.
Well, I know, but, you know, if there are police outside the studio, will you bail me out?
I will.
But that's finding a good retailer, passionate retailer, is the best way. I mean, someone who knows your taste, who's going to turn you on to good wine, someone who really loves their job. One of the things that we've, one of the problems with retail culture in the United States is that a lot of them stopped selling wines and started selling points, Parker points, Wine Spectator points, and so forth. But there are lots of passionate retailers, too, people who are just so into the product and want to turn you on to great wines. And, you know, making friends with a retailer like that. But alternatively, if you walk into a store and don't know what you're looking for, at least in the French section or Italian section, turn it around. I include in my book a list of the importers whose portfolios you can count on to deliver pleasure.
And what do you think about natural wines, organic wines? You write about something called biodynamics.
Yeah, biodynamic is interesting. It's sort of there's a mysticism involved with it. I mean, things like, you know, burying cow horns filled with cow dung in the vineyard. And
so people do that,
but it's been embraced by some of the most acclaimed wineries in the world. I don't think any of the sort of more mystical new age stuff has really anything to do with it. What I think these people are doing is they're just applying such fanatical care to their vines. And, you know, it's sort of it's now almost a cliche, but great wines are made in the vineyard. That's what every great winemaker will tell you. And so it's not the cellar, it's the vineyard. And that's one of the reasons we're drinking so well these days, because this has become mantra for winemakers all over the world. And the good ones are spending just fanatical amounts of time in there, working their vines, working their soils. And, you know, that has the biodynamic is sort of ultra organic. Mm. And it does produce, these wines have sort of an intensity, an almost feral character. That's very appealing. So I don't buy the new age hooey with it, but it's delivering
interesting history, right?
It's delivering good wines.
We have a tweet from Jay. What does he think about New Jersey wines? Have you looked at New Jersey wines?
No, I have to plead ignorance on this one.
You'd rather go to Burgundy than
I don't want to put it quite so caustically, I guess. Why don't we just say I'm in favor of viticulture wherever it happens? How about that? Is that a diplomatic answer?
It is. It is indeed. Let me ask you about this this wine fraud case that you wrote about. The guy was actually just found guilty. His name is Rudy
Carniwan. Yeah.
And this is a story that goes back a number of years, and he was living large, shall we say.
This guy came out of nowhere, Indonesia. The story was that he was the son of a wealthy Indonesian, ethnic Chinese, that his name had been changed. He was given an Indonesian name to protect his identity. The guy shows up in the early 2000s and takes the wine world by storm.
Buying and selling.
Buying
right?
incredible amounts of wine. He's rumored to be buying $1 million a month at auction. And I mean, I would see this guy at auction and I'd look at him and say, if he walked into my wine shop, I'd cart him. Because he looked so young, and there was no way. And then he really made a huge splash when he, two auctions in 2006, he sold $35 million worth of wine. Basically, what happened is in 2008, he consigned some wines to an auction in New York, some Burgundies, old Burgundies. Basically, the way Burgundy works is, you know, you have domains, estates, and they own sections of vineyards, and this was from a vineyard, a Grand Cru vineyard called Clos Saint-Denis, and he consigned almost 36 or so bottles of Domaine Ponceau Clos Saint-Denis from the years 1945 to 1971. Here was the problem. Domaine Ponceau didn't acquire vines in the Clos Saint-Denis vineyard until 1982. So this kind of tripped him up. He got arrested in March 2012, was put on trial earlier this month in New York, in a federal court in New York, and was found guilty, wire and mail fraud in connection with the sale of fraudulent wines.
And my understanding is this is the first case in this country of
the federal government, the first case pursued by the federal government. Right. Bill Koch, a billionaire collector
the
from
Koch
Florida.
Brothers,
he is one of the Koch brothers, not one of the two that get all the attention, but this is Bill, their brother, and he has been on the warpath over the issue of wine fraud. Since 2005, when he sued a German wine impresario for selling him Four bottles of wine that purportedly belonged to Thomas Jefferson.
how would you know? I mean,
well, this guy claimed he found it in a hole in the wall in Paris, literally a hole in the wall in Paris. And so it was a huge scandal. And so Coke has said that he has bought other wines that have been judged to be fraudulent at other auctions. And he's been suing a lot of people, including this guy, Kernighan. But the federal government went after Kernighan first.
Well, and one of the things that Kernighan used to do would be to get after, I guess, a party or some kind of an event, he would ask for all the empty bottles.
He would. And would collect them. Now, I would say that there was nothing, you know.
Is that weird?
No, it's not. Because, I mean, for instance, on my desk, much to my wife's chagrin, I keep a huge selection of empty bottles of trophy wines that I've had the pleasure of tasting. I'm very sheepish now about taking bottles from tastings because, you know, people look at you like, oh, what do you do with that? But
yes.
This guy was getting boxes and boxes of empty bottles sent back to him. And when the FBI arrested him in March 2012 at his home in suburban Los Angeles, they found a counterfeiting factory in his house. You know, he was taking labels from old bottles. He was printing new labels. And so what it appears he was doing is he was taking the empty bottles and refilling them.
Do we know?
Well, I know, for instance, he was buying, like, cheap Burgundies and cheap Bordeaux. I think he was blending. That's what it appears that he was doing. He was blending some less heralded Burgundies and Bordeaux with California wines, younger California wines. That seems to have been what he was doing.
You told me one of the arguments from the defense was that he was using all these labels because he was going to buy a big house and use it as wallpaper.
That was one of the things they suggested. They were looking for less nefarious explanations for this guy's activities, and they said, you know, maybe with all these labels, he was just going to wallpaper his new house in Bel Air. The jury suppressed a laugh. I couldn't. But
were you in the courtroom?
I was in the courtroom. The defense didn't mount much of a defense. Didn't have much of a case to make. The interesting thing is, I mean, I think this guy had to have had help. He put a lot of fake wine on the market, and one guy, and just from what I, you know, from the reporting I did, he was sort of a slacker. He was sort of disorganized and so forth.
He wouldn't get up till all hours of the morning.
He would sleep till noon and so forth. Just not really on the ball in a lot of ways. And so to be running this quite sophisticated scheme just by himself.
Yeah.
But he didn't give up anyone, it doesn't appear. And he went to trial instead of pleading guilty and was just convicted.
I do want to drink another little sip of wine, but we have a question from Kevin. Any recommendations for cooking wine? Wine, I guess, for cooking. Do you have any?
Well, my wife is a cookbook editor. This comes up quite often. She just wrote a cookbook editor and writer. Her name is Kathy Brennan. She just wrote a very fine new cookbook called Keepers and also was the recipe editor for the Gramercy Tavern cookbook, which came out this fall as well. It was a very literary year in our household.
A lot of writing going on.
Exactly. And so, you know, she has always told me that, you know, better wine, the better the wine for cooking, the better the result, but within reason. You know, she has never raided my wine cabinet downstairs. I'm not missing it. No $200 bottles have ended up in the sauce, fortunately, but that does happen.
Have you checked for fingerprints or anything like that?
Well, you know, it's I trust her not to do that, but, I'll have to start worrying about my kids in a couple of years, but no, that hasn't happened yet. Right. So, you know, within reason. I mean, one doesn't need to spend $30, I don't think, on a cooking wine, but using a $3 wine might not get may not yield the sauce you want.
Well, let's
let's try
final
this.
Bottle
you got
here.
It. All right, this is
I'm leaning over here.
You got it. This is one, I would say, and I say in the book, this is probably my most consistently favorite wine in the world. This is a Beaujolais. From a producer called Marcel Lapierre. You know, we think of Beaujolais. We think of Beaujolais Nouveau. We think of those very flowery bottles we see between Thanksgiving and New Year's. And it was a great idea hatched by a producer in the Beaujolais region named Georges Dubuff. It was a great marketing campaign, but it had unintended consequences and very onerous consequences for the Beaujolais region. It got in the heads of consumers around the world that Beaujolais was just the seasonal drink, that Beaujolais Nouveau was the only Nouveau you had. It was the only Beaujolais you had to concern yourself with. And it really created huge problems for the image of Beaujolais over the long term. This is a producer who represents the other Beaujolais, an artisanal. This is a Morgon. This is from one of the 10 appellations in the Beaujolais region that produce the most serious wines. And Morgon is, along with Moulin-Avant, one of the two most serious. And this guy makes absolutely incredible wines. This is with a grape called Gamay. And
pretty color.
Isn't that gorgeous? And
yes,
just the aromatics on this wine. We talked about aromatic complexity.
Oh, wow.
I mean, you could just, you don't even need to taste this.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't not taste it because it's kind of, it's really good, but you, the aromatics on that, it's just incredible. And
let's take a little taste here. Oh, nice.
Isn't that nice?
Yes.
It's light. I mean,
again, very light.
It's light. I mean, this is, you know, 12.5% alcohol. Let me see. It's, yeah, 12.5%. The only thing I could say with this is you need two bottles because the first one's going to disappear in a hurry. But this is, I mean, you don't need, and one of the points I make in the book is you don't need to spend a lot of money on wine. $15 to $25, $30 is the sweet spot these days. There's so much great choice. It is true that, you know, if you spend, you know, certainly in a place like Burgundy, if you spend $50 or $60, you're going to get a better wine than if you spend $20. But you don't need to spend a lot of money to drink really exceptionally well. I mean, this was made by a producer named Marcel Lapierre. He died a couple years ago. His son has taken over for him. But Marcel Lapierre is one of the great winemakers in the world. Not just a great Beaujolais winemaker, but one of the great winemakers in the world. But just because it's Beaujolais, it doesn't have the prestige that you'd find in Bordeaux or Burgundy. These are wines that were selling for $20, $25, but incredible.
We're almost out of time here. So, what are you going to be doing on New Year's Eve?
Yeah, we do have plans. We made plans to go out with some friends for Korean food, and I'm going to bring beer.
After all that,
isn't that unbelievable? But you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, this whole thing. I mean, it's the fallback answer for all these sort of embattled wines in Europe, like, you know, like Sauternes. You know, they sit there and say, "Oh, it goes with Asian food." Well, you know, some do and some don't, and I've tried wine with Korean lots of times, and, you know, it just doesn't work.
Oh.
I'm not going to fight it anymore. Bring some good beers along.
Sounds great.
And, you know, that's a shameful admission for a wine writer, I suppose. But
Well, we came full circle. Michael Steinberger, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you
today
for having me on
Radio Times. You're welcome. And the book is called The Wine Savant, A Guide to the New Wine Culture. And again, he's the wine writer for Men's Journal. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can learn much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email archives, podcasts, and satellite radio. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.